Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, last year around this time, we presented a gathering of tales from a festival of storytelling at Palswood Garden down in Federal Way, Washington. It was an ear-opening experience, not just for the occasional jet approaching SeaTac, but as a reminder of the power of well-told stories. Talented storytellers remind us to slow down, disconnect from the whirl of modern life, and wrap ourselves up in voice, memory, and imagination. Highlights this year included North Carolinian Donald Davis's story of a remarkable kindergarten teacher. Linda Gorham weaved together the real and imagined lives of her Uncle Andy and Wilma Rudolph, both Olympic track stars. And Antonio Sacre shared insightful Cuban sayings, dichos, passed down by his father. The 6th annual Palswood Garden Storytelling Festival took place on July 22nd. KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the tales. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, storyteller Donald Davis tells us about an unforgettable woman who never forgot him.
When I was 5 years old, we didn't have kindergarten when I was 5 years old. But instead of being able to stay home and play, my mother sent me to Mrs. Rosemary's kindergarten in the basement of the Methodist Church. Mrs. Rosemary was a woman of indeterminate age who told us that if we measured her, we would find out she was exactly the same distance around all the way up and down from top to bottom. She said, it's easier to get dressed that way because your clothes fit no matter how you put them on, front to back, back to front. Yeah. She had these rimless glasses with little gold earpieces and her hair. Her hair looked like an old-fashioned bathing cap that had little curls just glued all over it. We just knew she could go home in the afternoon and pull her hair off and, you know, just wash it out and hang it up on the bedpost, let it dry out, put it back on the next day. Now, Mrs. Rosemary could have taught Mr. Rogers. Because, you see, they both knew that the only way you keep up with a five-year-old is not by speeding up, but by teaching the whole world how to slow down. No matter what we ever started in kindergarten, we did it as long as we wanted to. Why not? It was kindergarten. Every Monday was a holiday. We started right in and had Labor Day. The next Monday, we had Halloween. The Monday after that was Thanksgiving. Last Monday in September, Christmas. By the time we got to December, we had finished all the holidays. She just turned the calendar around. We started all over again. We had every holiday at least 3 times that year. Why not? It was kindergarten. Every Friday was somebody's birthday. When we came to Friday, somebody turned 6 years old. There was a little plaster of Paris birthday cake that you could fit candles in, and we'd have fresh candles every Friday. We'd celebrate another birthday. But by December, everybody was 6 years old. We just started over again. By Easter, everybody was 7 years old. By the time I got out of kindergarten, I was 8 years old. Best year of birthdays I ever had. Why not? It was kindergarten. Now, every day, my favorite thing, I would listen for these magic words, rhythm band. Because if you got your hand up in a hurry, you might get to play the one little loose-headed drum, the one little triangle, or this one magical thing that was called the whip. It would be illegal today, but it sure was fun. It was two thin strips of board that had a hinge at the bottom and handles on the outside. You would open it up and you would smack it together and it would make a crack that sounded like the building was coming down. If you were slow getting your hands up, you got stuck with the wood blocks. Stupid little blocks of wood had sandpaper glued to them. They weren't worth anything. I used to think my wood blocks were no good because the sandpaper was worn out. Till I got some with brand new sandpaper, they weren't any better. Well, then we'd all line up, and she would pick somebody to be the leader. The leader got to carry the baton, which was actually a piece of a broomstick that had glitter glued to it and a rubber ball on each end so you couldn't jab somebody's eye out with it. And then following the leader, here we'd march playing our music around the church, around the block, around the church. Around the block, as long as we wanted to. Now, there was one bad boy in kindergarten, Bobby Jensen. He was so bad. Bobby Jensen could spend an hour moving at the speed of the shorthand on the clock to get in exactly the right place to see a girl's underwear. He was so bad. One day we got to kindergarten and we were playing outside. It had rained the night before, so all the sand in the sandbox was wet and it would stick together. And I spent the whole morning making a perfect little row of matched frog houses. When just as I got it finished, along came Bobby Jensen. Chunk, chunk, chunk. Accident, 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 he said. And I went to tell on him. Mrs. Rosemary wouldn't listen. She got out two chairs. She put me in one chair. She put Bobby Jensen in the other chair. And she scooted us up till our knees touched. She said, "Boys, let me tell you something. When you have something important to say to someone, you don't send a messenger. You tell them straight out yourself." And she made me talk to that bad boy. I never did like that. Now, in North Carolina, by the time you get to October, the first big full week of October is State Fair Week. When that week came along, Mrs. Rosemary told us we were going to have the State Fair in kindergarten. Monday was Pie Day. We spent all day making mud pies and baking them in the church ovens. We did things all through the week, but the big news was Friday was going to be Livestock Day. On Friday, we were supposed to bring all of our pets and any other animals we wanted to bring, and we would have a big livestock parade, and we would get ribbons, you know, red ribbons and blue ribbons and all kinds of ribbons. And I was upset because the only pet I had was a dead goldfish. And it was buried in the nasturtiums, and I thought, I won't even be able to find it by Friday, and it won't win either. But my daddy heard about the plan, and he told my mother to take me to the Bergen's Dairy Barn and let me get a kitten. And that next afternoon, we went over to the Bergen's Dairy Barn, and we spent about 2 hours interviewing candidates. And then we went home with Judy. Judy was warm. That was the first thing you knew about Judy. As soon as you touched Judy, Judy was warm. And Judy was soft. And she was white and orange and black. And she had a little tail that looked like what's left of a pencil when it won't reach in the pencil sharpener far enough to sharpen anymore. And I took Judy home, and the next day, Judy went to Livestock Day, and Judy won the blue ribbon for the newest pet. I, I thought she might win the smartest pet, you know, ribbon too, but Tommy Connor brought a big worm and it won that one. Well, that Sunday afternoon, after Sunday dinner, we got in the car to go to my grandmother's house. We always went on Sunday afternoon. My daddy started the Plymouth. He let out the clutch. All of a sudden, something under the car went, ba-bam! And my daddy stopped. And Judy ran out from under the car and fell over. And her little legs were running in the air. And by the time we got there, her legs stopped. And she breathed her last little breath. And instead of a trip to my grandmother's house, we had a cat funeral. I tried to talk to my parents about it, but they couldn't help because they were parents. And they said foolish things like, it was only a kitten. And even worse than that, you could always get another one. And I had to go back to kindergarten on Monday and tell Mrs. Rosemary that my blue ribbon kitten died for no reason. She gathered us up and she said, now, boys and girls, let's come and sit down on our talking rug. And we all got down on the floor and she said, now, let's talk. All of us know that sometimes things die. But let me tell you, children, something. Nothing ever dies for no reason. If something dies, it either means it got too hurt to get well, or it got too sick to get well, or if it was oh so lucky, it just got too old to be well. 5 years old, that took care of me. She had given me an answer instead of ignoring me. My kitten just got too hurt to get well. Well, Mrs. Rosemary's assistant was Mr. Rosemary. He was an old, tall, completely bald-headed man, no hair anywhere around his ears or anywhere else. We were scared of Mr. Rosemary. Mr. Rosemary had a hole in his throat through which he breathed. He wore a little bib that was supposed to cover it up, but when he would bend over, we could see it, and we did. And he had a little speaking tube he talked with. One end went in his mouth, the other end against the side of his throat, and when he talked, it sounded like a robot. One day he came to school and he and Mrs. Rosemary were over in the corner of the room speaking robot talk. And we were all huddled down in the other end of the room. And finally he left and she said, oh, boys and girls, you're not afraid of Mr. Rosemary, are you? She said, boys and girls, it's okay. Mr. Rosemary was gassed in the war. And he only has one lung. And then she said, if you're afraid of him, just wait till tomorrow. I didn't sleep at all that night. Well, the next day we got to kindergarten. In came Mrs. Rosemary. In came Mr. Rosemary. They both got us down in the floor, and we all took turns finger painting Mr. Rosemary's bald head. And while some of us were finger-painting his bald head, the rest of us got to play with the speaking tube to see if we could sound like robots. We were never scared of him again. Mr. Rosemary had retired from the pet dairy company, where he told us he had been the chief ice cream mixer. And now that he was retired, he had a little workshop at their house, and that's where he made all of our wonderful toys for kindergarten. Mr. Rosemary made our sandbox. It was a two-story sandbox. On the ground level, there was sand, and then little circular stairs that went up to a second story that in a moment of imagination could be the top of a castle or the bridge on a ship. Mr. Rosemary made huge, big wooden boxes that were painted like giant blocks that we would stack up and learn to balance things with. Mr. Rosemary had flattened pot lids to make cymbals for the rhythm band. He made the whip. Yeah. He made all kinds of things. We didn't have one single thing that had been bought at the store. Mr. Rosemary made all of it. Well, one day we got to kindergarten, and in came Mrs. Rosemary, and with her was a tall woman she introduced to us as Mrs. Hale. She said, "Boys and girls, this is Mrs. Hale. She's going to be your teacher for 4 days. I have to be gone for 4 days, boys and girls, because last night, Mr. Rosemary died." Anybody else would have sent a messenger, but that would have broken her rule. She had to tell us straight out herself. We got down in the talking circle. She even made Mrs. Hale get down there, I think just to see if she could do it. And she said, "Now, boys and girls, we mustn't be frightened about this. Remember Mr. Rosemary's one lung. And remember, nobody dies for no reason. If somebody dies, it means they either got too hurt to get well, or they got too sick to get well. Or if they were, oh, so lucky, they just got too old to be well. Mr. Rosemary just got too old to be well." And with a little tear and a kiss for each of us, she told us goodbye, and we saw her next 4 days later.
To hear the conclusion of Donald Davis's story about Mrs. Rosemary, go to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Next up, Linda Gorham pieces together fragments of a moment that changed her family and the world.
So my Uncle Andy, he's the one that walked around in a tracksuit all the time, and my mother fussed about it all the time, because you don't come to Thanksgiving dinner in a tracksuit. But once you're an Olympic star, you're an Olympic star for the rest of your life. And I think he wanted everybody to know it. It was clearly the highlight of his life. And I think that's kind of hard on people, because once you get that high where you're that revered for a few moments in time, now what? How do you follow that? So I sat down with Uncle Andy a while back and I said, "Tell me about your story. What made you run?" And he said, "Oh, Linda, I don't even tell my daughter or my son that. I haven't told your cousins, but if you want to know, I'll tell you." I said, "Okay." He said, "It was back in the 1930s. I was born in Washington, D.C., where I lived, and I was about 12 years old, and I got a newspaper route. And it wasn't easy. You had to get up early before school. You had to go get the newspapers. You had to sort them. You had to bind them. You had to put them in a big sack. I didn't have a car, a bicycle," he said. "I had to walk my whole route." And I did that for many, many, many weeks, for a couple of years. He said, "Every other week on Friday, I would go back through the route and collect my money. One Friday, I was about 12 years old. This was Washington, D.C. in the 30s. You all know this was a segregated place. Part of my uncle's paper route was in the what was called Negro section, and part was in the white section. He said, "And I was collecting money in the white section. Some boys chased me. I'm sure they didn't want me in their neighborhood. They chased me, they caught me, they beat me up, they stole my money." He said, "I told myself I was never going to get beaten up and chased and robbed ever again. And I told myself nobody was ever going to catch me." And he said, "I didn't even tell anybody that I got beat up." I said, "How can you not tell anybody? They could do something." He said, "Linda, you don't know the times. Back then, nobody was going to do anything about it, even if I could identify them." He said, "So I didn't tell anybody, but what I started doing is every day after school, I would come to the house after school, do my homework, I'd look at the clock in the living room, and then I'd go outside, run around the block, come back in and look at the clock again to see how long it took me to do it. And every day I did it, I would try to beat my time, and then I would go farther and farther and faster, and they did chase me again," he said. "They didn't catch me because I was fast." And when he got to high school, he probably was fast. And he also said that he thinks he was naturally fast. He got to high school. He made the high school team. That was a no-brainer. the Ferris, the Lincoln High School team in Jersey City, New Jersey, during the 4 years that my Uncle Andy was there, won county, state, regional, county, and state championships all 4 years. That team led by my Uncle Andy. He got a full scholarship to Seton Hall University, where he ran again. He won 9 out of 8 outdoor titles. He ran the 60-yard dash, the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash, the 4x100-meter relay, and the high jump. His longest long jump, 24 feet, 4 1/4 inches. I'm 5 feet tall, so it's roughly 5 of me. That's pretty tall. And then it was a natural for him to go to the Olympics. Everyone thought he was going to win gold in 3 events: the 100 meter, the 200 meter, and the 4x100 meter. He had already held the world record in the 100 meter dash by that time. So they just knew he would win. But because of the ankle injury, he only ran 2 events and he won gold. He came back a superstar. There was articles about him. My aunt had 5 binders full of articles about my Uncle Andy. And there was a ticker tape parade in Jersey City, New Jersey, the first African-American man, and as far as my research could tell, the only African-American man to have a ticker tape parade in Jersey City, New Jersey. They rode in a red convertible. The reason it was red, because he was colorblind, and red was the only color he could see. So they rode in a red convertible down that street, which is now called Martin Luther King Boulevard, no surprise. And it was a big deal. Well, when he went back in 1956, he was already a star because he had won 2 gold medals. And that was the year that Wilma Rudolph went to the Olympics for the first year, and she was also on the track team. She was slated to run the 100, the 200, and the 4x100-meter dash, a relay. I did not get to ask my uncle what his relationship was with Wilma Rudolph, because I didn't know the connection back then, and he didn't mention it when we talked about it. Hello, it's all about him, which is what he did. He lived. So I can only imagine that Wilma Rudolph looked at him as a star and someone who already had gold and someone that she wanted to emulate. Well, how do you tell a story about someone who you've never met and you've only researched and you want to tell it in a way that maybe will make her emotional state clear to the audience? She didn't have a diary, so I thought, what if she did? So here's her story. I changed the ages a little bit just to make the whole thing flow. You know, storyteller's prerogative. Age 4, dear diary, I'm always sick. I don't like being sick. I'm always sick. I have to sit in the house all the time and look outside and see my brothers and sisters playing. They are always playing basketball. I want to play basketball. I don't like being sick. Age 5, dear diary, Dr. Coleman came by the house again. He always comes by. He is a nice man. I do like him. He has brown skin like me. But every time Dr. Coleman comes in, he looks at me, examines me, you know, and then he takes Mama into the other room. But before he does, as he's leaving, he goes, I always know it's going to be bad news. When he takes Mom into the other room, they think I can't hear. Well, when I had itchy skin, he took Mama in the other room and he said chicken pox. And another time when I had itchy skin, he said measles. And another time when my neck was really sore, he said mumps. And then one time when I was really, really weak, Dr. Coleman, when he was in the room with Mama, he said scarlet fever. Mama says I shouldn't say hate, but I hate being sick. Age 6. Dear diary, I'm coughing all the time, especially at night. Oh, it hurts so much when I cough. Dr. Coleman came by again. He looked at me. He shook his head. Then he took Mom into the other room like he always does. Don't I know I can hear them? This time he said pneumonia. When Mama came out, looked like she was really upset. Mama told me I can't go to school now. I was supposed to start school, but she says I can't because if I go to school, I might get other children sick. So I have to stay home and be taught at home. I hate being sick. Mama keeps saying, don't say hate. Age 7. Dear Diary, the coughing stopped. I'm so happy. Dr. Coleman came by and he said I could go to school. I'm healthy. I'm finally healthy. No more looking out the window and listening to the radio and watching my brothers and sisters playing. Now I can go to school. Maybe I'll have friends. You know what, dear diary? I asked my mama to get me a new dress. And mama shook her head. Mama said, Wilma, you know we can't afford a new dress. You know we don't have that kind of money, but I'll make you a new dress out of this nice potato sack. You ever wear a potato sack dress? They're real itchy. And Mama says she can't afford to buy lining either. But you know what? At least I get to go to school, and at least I get a new dress. Second grade. Dear Diary, I'm 7 years old. I finally started school. I'm finally beginning to make friends. I don't know if I'm going to be able to go anymore. When I got out of bed, I fell on the ground. And I looked at my leg, and my leg was all twisted, and my foot was twisted, too. And I don't know what that means. And then Dr. Coleman came by, and he looked at my leg, and he, you know, I wish he would stop doing that. Then he took Mom into the other room. They were in there a long time. I could hear Mama crying. And when they came out, it looked like Dr. Coleman had been crying too. And he sat next to me and he held my hands and he said, Wilma, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you have polio. Well, then I started crying, too. And then he showed me something really ugly. He had a picture of a boy wearing a polio brace on his leg, and it started at his knee, and it went down to his ankle, and it was ugly. And Dr. Coleman said it was made of steel, and he said I was going to have to wear it. And then he showed me those big old ugly brown Oxford shoes, too. I don't want to wear it. But Dr. Coleman said if he can get it for me, because Mama can't afford it, but if he can get it, I gotta wear it. This is a bad day. Dear diary, I got the brace. They have braces for people who can't afford it. That's kind of nice. And Dr. Coleman said I should be happy about that. But it's ugly and it's heavy. And when I go to school, now Tommy and Mary and Jonathan and Thomas, they make fun of me. They call me names. And I don't like it. They call me cripple. That's a terrible name. Mama says we have to go to the hospital twice a week. We have to go all the way to Meharry Hospital in Nashville so I can get my legs massaged so my legs will get stronger. I don't mind. I like riding the bus with Mama. But I said to Mama, why do we have to ride in the back seat of the bus? And Mama said, that's the law. If we don't ride in the back, we could be arrested. And I told her that's not fair. And she said, I know, Wilma. I know it's not fair. And then Mama told me a story. Mama said, Wilma, when you were born, you were so pretty. And you were so tiny. You were born 2 months early, and I could hold you in my hand. You were such a pretty little baby. But Dr. Coleman came by when he delivered you, and he said that you needed to be in an incubator. And he told me I should take you to the hospital right away, and I took you to the hospital right here in Clarksville. But they wouldn't let me in. The lady at the door said, you know we don't treat people like you here. I'm sorry about your baby, but you should take it home. Take that little girl home and wrap her up and keep her near the oven. I hope she lives. So I did, Wilma. I wrapped you up. I took you home. I kept you as warm as I could, but that's why you're so sick, Wilma. Dear Diary, I knew we can't try on shoes at their stores. I know we can't always try on hats. I know we have to sit in the back of the bus. I know we have water fountains labeled colored. I know we can get somewhere first, but we are waited on last. But I didn't know people would let me die. A little baby? Maybe if I'd been in the incubator, maybe I wouldn't have been so sick. Why are some people so mean? Dear diary, age 9. I have to wear the brace every day. I can take it off at night, but I still have to wear it. But they still make fun of me. But Mama keeps saying, be patient. Well, how can I be patient? I want it off, but Dr. Coleman says I can't take it off. And Mama says I can't take it off. And I want to be patient. But there's one good thing. We don't have to make that 100-mile trip to Meharry Hospital anymore twice a week. Because now, well, Mama learned how to massage my leg, and Mama taught all my brothers and sisters how to do it, too. She said, I'm lucky because I have 21 brothers and sisters. Some people say that's a lot. You think so? Mama says, I have lots of people to help massage my leg so my leg will get strong. That's a good thing. Sometimes it hurts when they massage it, but I don't say anything because Mama said I should be patient, and Mama said I should do whatever Dr. Coleman says. But I sure want polio to go away. Age 9 and a half. Dear diary, I did it. I did it all by myself. It was Sunday, and everybody was in the church, and the church was all full, and I stood in the back, and I unbuckled that brace, and I took it off. And I didn't even hold the chairs. I didn't. I walked up the middle of the church aisle all by myself, and the people started seeing me, and they started saying, you go, Wilma, go ahead, Wilma, good for you, Wilma. And then others were saying, yes, Wilma, yes, Wilma. And then they all started saying, Wilma, Wilma, Wilma. And Dr. Coleman, he was there too, and he said, Wilma. And I made it all the way to the front where Mama and Papa were sitting, and I sat down next to them, and they hugged me. One day, I'm not going to have to wear this brace ever again. It was a good day. Age 10. Dear diary, Dr. Coleman said it's finally over. We can mail that brace back to Meharry Hospital at Fisk University. I don't have to wear it anymore. I still have to get massages for 2 more years, but I don't have to wear it anymore. Maybe now I'll be normal. Maybe now I'll have real friends. Maybe now I'll play basketball. That's what I really want to do. Dear diary, I've been watching my brothers and sisters play basketball for 12 years. I've been looking out the window. I know how to play basketball, but the coach doesn't think I do. But the coach wanted my sister on the team. So Papa said, if you take Wilma's sister, you have to take Wilma too. I made the team. I'm going to show them how good I am. You watch. Age 13. Dear diary, all I do is sit on the bench. 3 seasons, and all I do is sit on the bench and watch everybody play. He's never let me start, the coach. Now, sometimes he'll let me play like 2 or 3 minutes, and that's all. But I can't get in a rhythm. I can't show him what I've got. He does like me. He calls me a nickname that I like, and the other kids do, too. He calls me Skeeter. That's because I'm so tall and so thin. I'm almost 6 feet tall, and I weigh 80 pounds. He says I dart around a little bit too much for him, he says. He says he's going to start a track team. He said if I learn to run, maybe that will help my basketball. I don't like to run. But Mama said I should try new things. So I told him, if you start a team, I'll join it. Age 14, dear diary. I finally got to start on the basketball team. Coach says my running has helped my basketball. Guess what? I scored 32 points. And everybody in the school gym, they yell, Wilma, Wilma, Wilma. This is the best day ever. Age 16. I have a lot to tell you, diary. I was running on the track team, and the coach from Tennessee State University said that I should join their team, their summer track team. And then when I did that, he said I was really good and I should try out for something called the Olympics. I don't know what it is, but he said it was good. So I said I would try, because Mama says always try something new. Guess what? I made the team. I'm going all the way to Australia, Melbourne, Australia. I'm going to represent the United States on the track team. Oh, I hope I win a medal. Oh, I hope I win a medal. I hope I win a medal. I did. Third place. 4x100, all four of us, the team, we won, and all of us hugged. My teammates are so wonderful. We won bronze. I'm coming back. I know it's a lot of work, 4 more years of work, but I want to come back because I want to win a gold medal. Yeah. Age 20. Dear diary, I won, and I won, and I won. 4 gold medals in the Olympics. Rome, Italy. 80,000 people were in the stands. American flags were everywhere. It was the first year that the Olympics was shown on TV. I learned later the whole country watched me win. And when I stood on that podium 3 times on the very top, all I could hear was, Vilma, Vilma, Vilma. I love how they say my name. And afterward, everybody came and wanted to talk to me and shake my hand and hug me. And now, dear diary, they are calling me the fastest woman in the world. Thank you.
In this last segment, LA-based writer and performer Antonio Sacre shares stories and lessons inspired by Cuba and his father.
Donald Davis is a storyteller that's with us today. Has anyone heard Donald Davis tell stories? So he's been a mentor and a teacher of mine, and I've been asking him a little bit about how do you gather family stories, and he says it's really just the people you know and the places you were. Where were you with those people? Who were those people? If they're still alive, you have the ability to call them on the phone and ask them about some of the places they knew, and if they're not, you can use your memories and remember them as well. This is my little writer's journal. How many of you have a writer's journal? How many of you have one and you never open it? How many of you have one and you're behind on your writing? You want to do whatever. How many of you kept a journal for when one of your kids were born, if you have kids? When my son was born, my wife gave me a beautiful, empty, crafted journal. And it was my first step. And there was like little prompts the first time, whatever it was. And I meticulously filled that in. It's a beautiful document. I can't wait for my son to be old enough to read it and do it. Then my daughter was born 2.5 years later, and my wife gave me the same book, and I wrote the beautiful story of her birth, and then never wrote in either journal again. How many of you have a second child? How many of you are the second child? Donald Davis told me this last night, actually. I was asking him about this. He said that he was the first child, and there's hundreds and hundreds of pictures of him and his brother, the second child. There's basically his birth picture, and that's it. So one of the things I do, I don't write about my kids anymore. I'm too busy trying to live with them and run around after them. But I talk to my dad on the phone every day, and whenever I do have this open. And every now and then, he says something that I know I have to write down. So what it is this. He knows dichos. Who's heard the word dicho? Okay, dicho means a saying, but if you're a Spanish speaker and you hear dicho, you actually hear more. You hear rhyme and poetry and wisdom and laughter and Bible verses and wisdom from the elders and things from Cuba. Every Spanish-speaking country has them. Some are the same and some are specific to the country. So for instance, in Cuba, they have camarón que se duerme, se lo lleva el corriente. If the shrimp sleeps all day, the current will take it away. In some states in Mexico, it's not the shrimp, it's some other animal because of the way the state is. But we have the same sort of thing. My dad speaks in dichos every 2 or 3 conversations, and when he does, I write them down. So the last week, I talked to him nearly every day. These are the things that he said. If I were to ask him to tell me all the dichos he knows, he would forget. He doesn't know. I'm keeping the dichos in my family. One of them was, he's now 82 years old, he's in wonderful health, I know he's going to live forever. He says, que verde era mi valle, y yo no lo sabía. How green was my valley, and I didn't even know it. And then I'm a children's book author as well. And part of my job is to write stories, and part of my job is to collect rejections. And he always asks me, do you have any books coming out? And I'll say, no, but I got a really great, beautiful rejection from a big publisher. They said, I'm an awesome author, but they can't publish the book. And every time I tell him that story, which is every couple times a year, he says, tanto al cántaro hasta que se pegue. I looked up all those words in the dictionary, and I couldn't find any of them. I said, what does that mean? He said, it's an old Cuban thing. And then it became a story. The women used to go down to the well with a cántaro, which is a great big ceramic pot, and they would carry water. And they would carry so much water back and forth that eventually that cántaro would se pegue, that ceramic pot would break, and they would have to get a new pot. So when I said I got rejected, he said, keep going to the well until that pot breaks, and then make a new pot. My dad doesn't write and doesn't know anything about writing, but that's phenomenal writer's advice. Make a pot. Go to the well with it as many times as you can, and when it breaks, make another pot. And then he loves baseball. So he said, the Red Sox are win, the Red Sox lose. He loves the Red Sox because of Boston. He loves the Minneapolis Twins or whatever the name of that team is. But the Red Sox lost. They're doing well, but they lost. And he said, ay, niño, la pelota es redonda, pero viene una caja cuadrada. The ball is round, but it comes in a square box. I said, what does that mean? He said, I don't know, but I love the saying, you know. So after 6 years of collecting these dichos, I've collected over 300 of them. I don't remember them. I have to go back to my journal. I try to use them with my son, talk to my son about them, and my daughter as well. And then about 6 years ago, going down to the well, trying to think about it, I came up with this story. It's a collection of 10 of my father's favorite dichos and a couple of small moment memories that I had going to my grandmother's house in Miami, Florida. Francisco wanted a mango from the tree. He said, Papa, I want to go pick a mango by the tree all by myself. He said, you know where that mango tree is? Sure, Papa. I walk out of our house and I pass my uncle's house. I love my uncle, Papa. Your uncle loves you too. Then I walk past my abuela's house. I love my grandmother, Papa. Your abuela loves you too. Then I walk past my tia's house, my auntie's house. I like my auntie. You don't love your auntie? Well, Papa, I love my auntie. It's just that sometimes she's nice and sometimes she's mean. How many of you have a mean auntie? How many of you are the mean auntie? He said, Papa said, Francisco, just visit your tia. She loves you. Okay, Papa, I'll visit my tia. And past my tia's house is the mango tree. He walked past his uncle's house. Uncle, I'm going to pick a mango. You're getting big, Francisco. Thank you, tio. He goes past his abuela's house. She didn't speak English. Yo voy a agarrar un mango, abuela. Muy bien, Francisco. He walked past his auntie's house. There she was, sweeping the top step con una cara de muy pocas amigas, with a face that looked like it had no friends at all. Sweep, sweep, sweep. Hola, tia. Nee. Adios, tia. Nee. He got to the mango tree. He climbed up the tree and was just about to pick a mango when he heard bzzz. Una abeja, a bee, bzz, dos, bzz, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, tantas abejas que él bajó el árbol, and he began to run past his tía. She was still sweeping that top step. Sweep, sweep, sweep. When she saw him run by, she went, nee, ran past abuela, ran past his uncle. Where are the mangoes? He got back to his papá. His papá said, Francisco, ¿encontraste el árbol? Did you find the mango tree? I did, papá. And were there mangoes in the tree? Uh-huh, there were plenty of mangoes in the tree. And how many did you pick? None. Ay, mijito, mejor pájaro en mano que 100 volando. It's better a bird in your hand than 100 flying in the air. What's that one in English? A bird in the hand is worth 2 in the bush. In Spanish, the way it rhymes in Spanish is, bird in the hand is worth 100 flying in the air. Mejor un mango en la mano que 100 en el árbol. It's better a mango in the hand than 100 in the tree. What happened? Papa, I was scared of the bees. Ay, mijito, no hay mal que por bien no venga. There's nothing bad that something good doesn't come from it. The bees can sting you and that's bad, but without the bees, we'd have no flowers. We'd have no fruit. Don't be scared of the bees. Take my hat and gently shoo the bees away. He took his papa's hat. He went past his uncle. My dad, help me. That's good. Dime con quién andas y te digo quién eres. Tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are. Your dad's a smart man. I know, papa. I know my papa is smart. He walked past his abuela. Abuela said, tanto al cántaro hasta que se pegue. Keep going to the well until you get a mango. Okay, abuela. He walked past his tía, and there she was. Sweep, sweep. He got to the mango tree. He climbed that tree, and there were the bees, and he was scared. But he remembered there's nothing bad, that something good doesn't come from it. And without the bees, there'd be no mangoes. He took his papa's hat, and he gently shooed those bees away. And he picked his very own mango, put it into the hat. He thought, I should get one for my papa. And my mama. And my uncle. And my abuela. And my auntie. No, I don't want to get one for my auntie. Yeah, I should get one for my... She's in a bad mood. She's like, me. I should get... Should he get one for his auntie? In Los Angeles, they're always like, no! Nothing for the auntie! I should live up here, not Los Angeles. These kids are like, yes, you're so sweet. He got one for the auntie. He put it in the hat, but now he had a problem. He needed to hold onto the hat with both hands. He also needed at least one hand to climb down. A little too high to jump, and if he threw the mangoes out, they'd get smushed. But then he figured it out. He put that hat on his chest, and very carefully he reached around the trunk of the tree, and he held on tight enough to not fall, but not too tight to squish the mangoes. And he started to scooch down the tree. Scooch, scooch, scooch. It was working. He was halfway down the tree. Scooch, scooch. He was 3/4 of the way down the tree. Scooch. He was 7/8 of the way down the tree. Scoot. He was 15/16 of the way down the tree when he held on just a little too tightly and one of the mangoes got smushed.
Psh. Ew.
Sorry, Auntie. Scoot. Ah, there goes Abuela's mango. Scoot. Ah, there's my uncle's mango. Well, I have 3 mangoes left. One for me, one for my mama, and one for my papa. Oh. By the time he got down, all the mangoes were smushed. And he remembered what his grandmother told him. El que mucho abarca, poco aprieta. If you try to grab too much at once, you end up with nothing. So he went up the tree. He grabbed 1 mango, put it under his chin, and down, and up, and down, and up, and down, until he had a hat full of mangoes. And he looked at his tía. He said, a mango's going to help her feel better. And even though he was scared, he walked up her long sidewalk, and she looked meaner and meaner until by the time he got there, he said, tía, do you want a mango? And he closed his eyes and waited for her to make that mean sound. But she didn't. When he opened his eyes, she wasn't smiling, but her face had relaxed. She took the mango out. She said, Francisco, yo tenía hambre, y cuando hambre toca la puerta, amor sale por la ventana. I was hungry, and when hunger knocks on somebody's front door, love goes running out of the back door. She said, that's why I was in a little bit of a bad mood earlier. He said, Auntie, you were in a lot of a bad mood. She said, don't push your luck. He gave a mango to his abuela. She said, pan para hoy, hambre para mañana. If you give away all of your bread today, you'll be hungry tomorrow. Don't worry, I've got plenty, abuela. He went to his uncle and gave mangoes to his uncle and his auntie and his cousins. And by the time he got home, they were all gone. His papa said, ay, mijito, de vez en cuando es mejor dar que recibir. Sometimes it's better to give than receive. Let's eat lunch and we'll all go get mangoes together. But as they were eating, all the family came with their mangoes, including tía with a basket full of mangoes. She said, mijito, amor con amor se paga. Love is repaid with love. And she gave those mangoes to him with a real smile. He took them from her. He said, tía, there's one thing I'd like to say to you. She said, what is that, honey? He said, me. She laughed and she said, barriga llena, corazón contento. With a full stomach, there's a happy heart. And that's the story called A Mango in the Hand. Gracias. Thank you.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. The 6th annual Palswood Garden Storytelling Festival took place on July 22nd. KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the tales. You can hear the full recordings on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon. Good night.